And this hour, Richard Dolan with us. We're talking about the FBI UFO document. Incredible story. We're going to take your phone calls as well when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Richard Dolan. We'll take calls in just a second. Richard, the occupants of these crashed saucers, reportedly, 3 feet tall, typical grays. Do we know anything about them?
No, I don't think typical grays. In the memo that we're talking about, as well as in the stories that were circulating around at that time, they didn't appear to have, like, the big black wraparound eyes. They didn't seem to have gray skin. They were not described in anything along those lines whatsoever. Basically, they were described as looking totally human, except they were miniature. They didn't look like children, so it wasn't like that, but they, you know, all that you really get from these stories is that they had perfect teeth. That was one thing that kind of came out a couple of times. So that's nice to know. And they look like people. What's an interesting story, I don't want to take up too much time from the callers, but I interviewed a man a few years ago who had, he was a retired high-level Air Force officer, a very well-educated man, and he had interviewed a person on his deathbed in a secure facility who had supposedly been at Roswell and had handled wreckage and bodies there. And what this officer said to me was that the guy he was interviewing, who was dying in this bed, was very credible to him because he described the bodies the way that this high-level guy, I'm not sure if he was a colonel, knew how they were, which was that they were not like grays. They were short, but they were human-looking, and they were kind of like nice-looking, except that they were short. So you get these descriptions from the late 1940s frequently. Mm-hmm. You don't get the grays. You don't get the grays, and you don't get it with this memo or with the Aztec story in general.
It's just amazing time period of what was going on during that time. We also had that crash at Cape Girardeau, Missouri, remember?
Yeah, it was from the early 40s, right, at the very beginning of World War I. There's a little bit less, a lot less information, actually, about that than in some of the other crash retrieval stories. But that case also doesn't have a horrible pedigree. It's not the worst case in the world in the sense that it seems to have been connected to the U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull, Hull had a friend who was a minister who they were very close friends. They'd grown up together. This minister told his daughters in later years about his conversation with Cordell Hull about these bodies, about the whole thing, the crash. And so, yeah, I mean, is that another case? Maybe it is. There are so many of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of books have been compilations of these crash retrieval stories. One was written by researcher Kevin Randall. One was written by Ryan Wood. I'm sure there's a few others that have tried to compile all of the various crash retrieval stories that we have. And you know, surprisingly, there's dozens of them that actually might be legitimate. And then there's dozens more which are just out there and who knows. Undoubtedly, I'm sure a lot of them are just spurious and we'll never get to the bottom of them. But when you really start looking into some of the evidence, I think people would be surprised that it's a little bit better than they might think.
Absolutely. And Richard, you know, you've looked at this for many, many years. You know, you've got a couple great volumes out there, UFOs on the National Security State. You're working on some other new projects. We'll get into that tonight. What does your gut tell you about this?
My gut tells me that they're, you know, in short, it's real and they're here, whoever they happen to be. Are they from another planet? I think, why not?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost become, passé to say that, oh, yeah, I believe in the extraterrestrial hypothesis, when so many times you hear people talking about interdimensional or time travelers. Mm-hmm. And there may be
demons coming down, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, all of these are possibilities. And I think that moving forward and into the 21st century, we, all of us researchers, need to keep a truly open mind because this is a phenomenon that is really well beyond our the paradigm of reality that we all grew up in. So we need to be open to that. But I think the extraterrestrial possibility is quite real. I mean, think about the last decade or two in terms of how many planets and the hypothesis for life out there in the universe, how that has grown in just one generation. It's extraordinary. We're now at the point where we've identified, I think, something close to 1,000 extrasolar planets definitively, and we know that there are billions and maybe trillions more. In terms of planets able to support life, it's a given now with astronomers that there's an enormous number of those. So if you look at our own civilization, I know your next guest will be talking about, highly intelligent machines.
Machines taking over. Yeah.
Well, that's a very strong interest of my own, and we are maybe one or two generations away from having computers that will be seeming to be conscious, that will convince us that they are conscious, that may have relative IQs of 500 or more, mm-hmm. however. So if that's the case, will we have the ability through these machines to travel through the galaxy? I think the answer has got to be yes.
Well, what's so amazing, too, Richard, about the machines, not to dwell on that, but I mean, as technology gets better and, you know, carbon fibers and the ability for movement to look not so robotic, but more human-like,
right.
There's no reason why these machines can't be programmed and developed to do incredible things.
Well, and there's no reason why these machines can't be almost fully biological as well.
Exactly.
You know, we're getting to a point with 3D printing, which is an incredible technology that's going to revolutionize our world, where they can do very probably 3D printing using living materials. Can you imagine another 20, 30, 50 years, they'll do a 3D printing with some artificial organism with advanced intelligence that may have some combination of biological and nano chips inside? Who knows, right? And is that what we are actually seeing? I've wondered about this when we deal with all of the variety of alleged alien beings. Are they simply artificially created organisms that are custom designed to function here on Earth? Maybe that's why they look like reptiles. Maybe that's why they look like humanoid gray aliens, because or insectoids, because we've got insects and we've got reptiles and we've got humans here. Maybe they're working off of our native DNA so they can function here.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point. Mike in Vegas, truck driving. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, Richard. How you doing, George?
Good.
I just wanted to say it's a real treat to be able to ask Richard a question. I've been reading his information for the last several years.
Super.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask about saucer technology. I kind of feel like the UFOs that crash are like old school stuff. Old school to them, new school to us, because they wouldn't want one of their state-of-the-art UFOs to crash, because then we'd have that technology. What did you think about that?
Yeah, well, I've often wondered, Mike, if the crash retrievals actually were maybe not unintentional, if they thought, well, we'll let these humans get this one. We've got a couple of disposable beings on there. Big deal if they get killed. We'll, you know, we'll give them a little bit of a...
Here's our old Ford Torino or something.
Yeah, I've wondered. you certainly look at the way the United States has traded with... you know, the less developed nations of the world, basically selling them technology that's not top of the line. You know, we Americans like to keep that to themselves. So is that the case with these crash retrievals? Yeah, I mean, why not? When you look at some of the designs of these saucers, at least as they're described in the 40s and 50s, they actually are quite advanced. You know, we tend to think, oh, yeah, they're like the old Model Ts. When you really read the descriptions in the intelligence reports, the performance capabilities of these things are still off the charts, even compared with what we apparently can do today. But I do think it's entirely possible that they've got a variety of models of different capabilities, and what we're seeing may very well not be the best. Sure. Speculation, but why not?
Francis, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico on the wild card line. You're on with Richard Dolan. Go ahead, Francis.
Yes. My question is, if aliens are so much more advanced than us, is it very quite well possible that they might have the cure for illnesses like AIDS or cancer? Could the cure for AIDS be something that's very elementary to them?
Well, it's a speculative question, but I would certainly hypothesize that they would. Of course, they might not, but I'm thinking more likely that they would. If they can go across a galaxy, let's just say, or if they can go across a dimension, they clearly would have access to a science that we would lack. That would be my thought. So they clearly would have the ability to manipulate space and time in a way that we don't yet understand. They would have certain mathematics that would be beyond what our civilization currently has attained. And with technology, particularly computing and artificial intelligence technology, that would, I would think, allow them, even if they didn't previously know our biology and know much about us, to figure out a lot of those questions. It's purely hypothetical, but sure, if I were hired to do counterintelligence for the people managing this problem, I would have to assume that would be a viable likelihood. So I would assume that they may very well know that.
End of June, I'll be at the Queen Elizabeth Theater in Toronto, major speaking engagement. And Richard, you will be my guest there, and they're looking forward to seeing you.
Indeed, I will. I'm looking forward to this very much as well, George. Very end of June in Toronto. It'll be a very nice experience.
I did that last year, and it's an incredible stage show. People are there, and it's going to be fun.
I was there. I wasn't a speaker, but I stood up and asked a question.
That's right.
You recall. And
that's right.
Chatted.
You were there. That's right. I think my daughter's coming out this year to see me.
Good. It's a really nice theater. It's a great.
Yeah, it is. We're going to have Alex Jones join us by Skype. Indeed. And David Hatcher Childress. And
right.
Should be fun. Okay, let's go to Bob in Bellevue, Nebraska, east of the Rockies. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. Thanks.
Good. Great show. I live in Bellevue, Nebraska, home of Offutt Air Force Base. And I was just wondering if your guest tonight had any idea of where the crafts would be stored and where they would take them. And if he thinks that they'll ever show us, the American public or the world, what they've got.
Well, that's disclosure, Richard, and that's right down your alley.
Well, it's been an interest of mine for quite some time. In terms of where the craft are being stored, incidentally, there's a number of bases where they have long been rumored. No one knows for sure. I heard good rumors about Fort Hood, Texas. Heard rumors about Manzano.
Of course, Wright-Patterson always comes up.
Wright-Patterson, absolutely. Of course, we've heard for years and years stories about S-4 near Area 51 in Nevada. There are many others. There's a story from, 40 years ago, one I think is true, with Jackie Gleason and President Richard Nixon, where they were at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, where Nixon took Gleason to view some alien bodies there. These facilities, these stories are, there's quite a few of them. And where the technology is primarily being stored, maybe even others in addition to that. In terms of disclosure, I have often felt that it's one of the great paradoxes of our time. I've often felt on one level it's an impossibility simply because the powers that be, I just don't see a motivation on their part ever to give this secret up.
No.
Too much to lose. But here's the thing. People have to remember that the powers that be are not the only part of the equation. We are part of the equation. Our ever-changing society is part of the equation. We're going through constant technological social revolution in a way that has never happened in the human past, ever. There's never been a period like what we're living through. And it's such an unstable situation that it seems to me that we're one generation away from being able literally to force disclosure because of our own ability to pry these secrets out. And I think we're getting closer and closer to that.
Stephen Greer is going to unveil his new film. I believe it's called Sirius. He's really excited about that. But tell him, what do you know about this little tiny alien he might have?
Well, I have been fascinated in this since he's been talking about it. It's been a number of months now. A 7-inch alien, non-human being is how they're describing it.
Dead?
It's dead, yeah, and there's, pretty decent resolution images on the web. Anyone can search. I it's an amazing thing for me because I think this is throwing down the gauntlet. If you do not deliver on this promise, it seems to me, you're throwing your credibility out the window forever and ever. I mean, you've got to be able to deliver the goods. So he's really upped the ante on everything having to do with this. But he has said that he's had top-level scientists and geneticists that have studied this. We don't know who these individuals really are. A couple of names have come out, but no top-level, top-flight surgeons and geneticists that I'm aware of have come out to light yet. Maybe they will.
We need that.
Well, absolutely, because otherwise, all you've got is just more talk. And if you don't deliver on this promise, it really seems to me that how will you maintain credibility if you do not deliver on this one? This is the Holy Grail
for him.
So I'm waiting. I think a lot of people are waiting, and I don't want to say one way or the other because I don't have access to the data. Only he does, and the people around him do. So really all that we can do is wait.
And you have to wait because he's waiting for this to come out. So.
We've got to be able to look at the data and have outside people investigate it and examine it.
Let's go to Dan in Montrose, New York. Hey, Dan, thanks for calling.
You know, George, last week when you spoke about this here, the Guy Holtzman memorandum,
yeah.
It just so happens I had my binder books open to that document and some documents with it. What is the coincidence of that? But anyway, my question to Richard is that, and this is what I've been working on with this. I've been looking at this for years. Only the Air Force would have that information about the radar bringing down the craft. I don't believe at all that a trickster would have that kind of information. The informants that they had, that they would have only been the ones to give it to them, that only the government would have that kind of knowledge that radar brought down those kind of crafts. Secondly and finally, these would be smaller crafts that were brought down, not motherships. So the very powerful radar would bring those crafts down, not any particular craft that would be for interstellar flight. Those would be those motherships, and that would have a different type of energy.
Right.
They couldn't be brought down. And they would be these smaller crafts that were brought down by radar, they would be like very short distances. And don't forget, we're being monitored by a number of different alien species. This is just one species and one particular type of craft that was affected by the radar.
What do you think of that, Richard? I always suspected the mothership was up there.
No, I think that's actually quite interesting. And, the idea about the radar taking these smaller craft down, and indeed all of the crashed retrievals that we know of are really not of huge craft. They're of small, relatively small, manageable-sized craft. It could very well be, think about it, that these other beings designed their craft in such a way that they were not anticipating radar. Radar was a brand-new invention in the 1940s. It was only used during World War II. Is it possible, crazy as it sounds, that these aliens did not foresee human radar screwing with their particular navigation system and that they corrected the problem by the 1950s? Hey, why wouldn't it be outrageous to think that? I don't know.
All right, Richard, we're coming back with final phone calls for you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, it's called Life on Anubis. Robert Harkin joins us as we talk about machines replacing man. Get ready for that. And when we come back in a moment with Richard Dolan, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, cruising back here on Coast to Coast, Richard Dolan with us. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What's the new work you're working on, Richard?
Yes, George. I've been writing a book that's been going on for the last, little more than the last year, and it's actually connected with a teaching. I'm doing an online program where I'm teaching a new introduction to ufology, believe it or not. People can take this online. It's with the International Metaphysical University, and it's an introduction to ufology. I went through a lot of work to put a fresh program together for anyone who really wants a new approach, to this topic that's just so incredible, such an amazing mystery, and covers so many different facets of our world. And on the basis of that, I'm just finishing up a book which I've called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, Understanding an Ancient Mystery in a New Era. And I try to cover the history, the philosophy, how to investigate UFOs today in an age of YouTube and Facebook where we're just flooded with information, the science connected to UFOs, not just propulsion, but
space-time and consciousness itself, all of these issues that I think really are important for serious students of the phenomenon to understand moving forward into the new era. It's a new introduction to UFOs. That's really what it is.
Richard, lots of folks have seen these large triangular-shaped objects. So they're seeing something, obviously.
That's right.
What are they seeing? What are they looking at?
Well, they're seeing something that's absolutely one of the most important aspects these days of the UFO phenomenon. And the question is, are they seeing something that we are making, or are they seeing something that someone else is making? I think the answer, in a sense, is both. The important thing to remember is that there is a group that's not from our civilization that's making these. I think that's the important thing to take away with the triangle phenomenon. And since you mentioned this, it'll just give me a chance to state, I don't just write books, but I do publish books by myself and other authors, and I'm about to publish a book by a gentleman named David Marler, who is writing the first book-length treatment on the triangle phenomenon.
Ah, okay.
It's going to be out. It's called An Estimate of the Situation.
I want him on the show, Richard. I want him on the show when it's time.
You do indeed. He's a fantastic researcher. Great great interview. He's extremely articulate. And he is, in fact, the foreword is going to be by Dr. John Alexander.
Super.
So we've got, David really has got the goods on the triangle UFO phenomenon. And his argument, as you will see, is that a lot of the good cases are not us. And I think he makes this point very, very well.
Well, I don't think we could hide anything that big, do you?
I wonder. I mean, I don't know. We can hide a lot of things. You know, every time I think we've hit our limit in terms of what they can lie about, what can be, hidden, I don't know. And I've speculated myself on the idea of what I call a breakaway civilization. That is, the black budget world that may have gone so advanced, so far beyond the rest of us poor slobs that they seem like, you know, another civilization. Is that possible, I wonder? And I think it is possible. On the other hand, it also is true that these triangles and some of these other UFOs, they don't seem to be from our civilization because, first of all, our jets chase them with regularity. Jets from the United States and from other nations are continually engaging these things. Even in our own era, we're still getting reports that slip out. The security around this matter, I think, is much better than it was in the past, and less is getting out. The Freedom of Information Act, frankly, is not as friendly as it once was in the 1970s. But it's becoming clear still that we're engaging these things. So I don't think they're all from our civilization, George.
Richard, do you get involved at all in alien abduction cases?
Oh, well, this has become an interest of mine for sure. You can't stay in this field for two decades and not bump into this phenomenon.
Okay.
In fact, not bump into it quite a lot.
I ask you because have you seen the movie The Fourth Kind about Nome, Alaska?
Absolutely. I've seen it.
I've got one of my producers is checking on this as a possible show for me, and we're not sure it's real. We think that might be just a Hollywood movie.
Well, it's all pure Hollywood.
Okay.
The guys who made that movie, I mean, if someone hasn't seen it, I don't want to spoil it, but it's a very creepy, it's a very well-made.
It looks like a documentary.
Exactly. They film it like it's a documentary, and the point is that there's this little town in the middle of nowhere up in Alaska where all of these abductions, I mean, horrific abductions are taking place and scaring the heck out of everyone. It's none of that's true. What they try to do is to create something based on some of the most sensational elements of the abduction phenomenon, and they tried to put all of that together into this remote area, but that did not happen.
They did such a good job that they duped a lot of people.
They did. Actually, shortly before that movie came out, a researcher who was vaguely connected with these people contacted me. And the reason he did is he said, this movie is about to come out. That's going to be very sensationalistic. And he said, I wonder if you can just give me all the data you have on the history of UFOs in the state of Alaska so that I can get it to these people so that
they can at least bring some factual information into it.
Yeah.
I said, really? So I did. I put together like a 30-page, 40-page. I've got a huge database of stuff with those. So
oh, yes, you
I
do.
Gave it to them, but it was way too late for that to have any impact on the movie. I don't think they were interested.
All right, let's go to final calls here. We'll go to Hood River, Oregon. Greg on the wild card line. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, good evening. I was wondering if you ever considered the connection of the UFO crash and a famous radio pundit. That's actually the hometown of Rush Limbaugh, Cape Girardeau.
That's right. Sure. No coincidence there. Now, that happened. What year did it happen, Richard?
1941, I believe.
Yeah, that is Rush's really? Hometown. And, you know, my granddaughter goes to college there. My son went to college there. They still talk about that case out there.
Sure. I had the impression that case sort of like was off the map for quite some time. But it was revived, and some of the researchers who revived it, as I recall, are some of the most level-headed.
Was it Leonard Springfield? Was he one?
Stringfield.
Stringfield.
I think Stringfield ran into the case in his research, but I don't know how deep he went. If I'm not mistaken, some of the researchers with the Center for UFO Studies, that's the J. Allen Hynek Center,
yeah.
UFOs, interviewed some of these individuals. Mark Rodiger, who's the head of UFOs, very, very level-headed, kind of conservative UFO researcher, you know, got into this case as well. And all he can say is that the individuals who've been interviewed here, these are the daughters primarily of the minister who really told the story. They're all totally credible. There's no, I don't think anyone who would meet these people or listen to them or read them would find any reason to doubt them. So it's an amazing story about a crash in that region and that the wreckage was taken. There was no Area 51, obviously. So it was taken east to Washington, D.C., and allegedly was held in an underground facility in Washington, D.C. for at least that period of time, the 1940s.
Okay, we go to Joe, Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Joseph, go ahead.
Good morning. Great show.
Thank you, Joe.
I was just wondering if you could tell me when was the last or most recent crash of a UFO?
That we know of, Richard. When was it?
Well, you know, for a little while we thought there was one in Needles, California that our friend George Knapp was looking into.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that one? That
yep.
was, less than 5 years, about 5 years ago, I'm thinking. George Knapp felt that that was not a legitimate UFO event. Offhand, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think. There's been a number of jet intercepts and close calls of these objects. You got me stumped. Off the top of my head, I really don't know which would be the last.
If anything, maybe in a different country, but we don't hear much about this.
There's one from Peru in the late 1990s, I think 1996, 97, I believe. That Stephen Greer actually helped to publicize in his book Disclosure.
Did you see the film of the Russian one? And I think, was that a hoax? Where these Russian soldiers are approaching a crashed UFO somewhere in the Siberia area?
Yeah. I know it's exactly what the image you're talking about. And I don't think that was the Dalnogorsk one. That was 1986. That was like the Russian Roswell. Maybe it was, but there was this photograph. You have Russian soldiers with this very large, kind of tall object. I have no idea if that's legitimate. I'm not the slightest clue if that is.
Sunnyvale, California, west of the Rockies. Chris is with us now. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, guys. In 2007, I did a combat tour in Kirkuk, Iraq, and part of my duty was doing night patrols with night vision goggles with a great group of guys. And, you know, there were some boring times, and we would sit up on the Humvee and just look at the night sky, and the night vision goggles, of course, it lights up everything, all the stars and everything, but we would see things crisscross the sky and actually change direction,
yep.
change course. It was amazing, and I got my camera and videotaped some of these movements. Can you tell me what I saw, firstly, and then also we did see the white triangle, well, in the night vision it was white, but the triangle moves slowly across the sky. I've got a photo of that. absolutely amazing. What did I see?
And Chris, were you using third generation night vision goggles?
Military night vision goggles. I'm.
They must have been very good.
They were good.
Yeah.
Well, here that's a great story. I'm so glad you mentioned it. I don't know if I can tell you what you saw, but I will tell you a story that you will find very interesting. I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a veteran of the Gulf War of 1990-91. And during Desert Shield, this was before Desert Storm, before the actual fighting, he was stationed out with a company. This guy was a captain. He was stationed with his group out, as he said to me, in the middle of nowhere, in the desert, in the Iraqi desert. And he was given information, intelligence, I think he said it was by Air Defense Command, somehow was communicating with him. And they said, in this particular sector of the sky, all right, you are not to fire any weapons, no matter what you see. And he said, well, okay. So he said, sure enough, a day or two later, we saw things in that sector of the sky. And I said, well, what things? He said, well, what do you think? They looked like flying saucers. They were zipping around. He said, the thing was, we could not have shot them down if we had tried.
Vermanas, that's what they were.
So, well, the thing is, I mean, this gives me the idea that U.S. military, this was something I think that the U.S. military was playing around with. I mean, how would they have known in advance that there was going to be something in that sector of the sky?
Yeah, that's true.
So, what you saw, Chris, I couldn't tell you. I don't know if it was something we made or if it was something that wasn't what we made. I don't know. I mean, what I do believe is that there are some highly advanced black budget technologies that have been that are being developed, but I also believe that there are other beings that are interested in what we do, and they too have a very strong interest in military engagements and our military facilities. Could have been either.
Do you know Ed Grimsley, Richard?
Yes.
All right.
A number of times.
Ed has night vision goggles, took me up on a hotel roof once, and I saw two incredible UFOs. Don't know what they are, so they're UFOs, darting along, just like Chris saw, doing 90-degree angles and everything else. Something was up there, and it wasn't an insect.
I did had night vision glasses on one sky watch on one occasion in Southern Illinois for a few hours. And I also, George, I saw a number of astonishing things in the night sky, things you just would never see without them. And I felt like I was underneath Grand Central Station in the middle of the night, but I also saw objects that were moving at a speed vastly beyond any aircraft that I could think of. But these were not meteorites and these were not satellites. They were, I don't know if they were trans atmospheric vehicles. They were something that was really fast.
It's exciting. It really is. Let's go to Ken, Grass Valley, California. Hey, Kenny, go ahead.
Hi. Richard, what do you know about the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania crash?
Well, it's one of the most legendary and, I would say, famous of all of the UFO crash cases. It took place December 9th, 1965. Kecksburg, Pennsylvania is the western part of that state, and it's very rural. Kecksburg is one of the cases that has almost as many good witnesses as Roswell. It's a good case. A lot of eyewitnesses saw an object come slam down there. There was an attempt by a skeptic, James Oberg, on one occasion to say that this was a Russian satellite. It was not a Russian satellite. We have absolute confirmation of that. What the thing was, we don't know, except that the U.S. military got really, really interested in sealing that area off. There were a number of firefighters who got in there to see it first. They and also a local radio man named Frank Murphy was very much involved in trying to publicize this, and it destroyed his career and probably his life. Looks like it was a crash UFO. That's what I would say.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. You are very, very welcome. Jonathan in Vivian, Louisiana, let's get you in here, John. Go ahead.
Hey, George, it's good to talk to you again.
You're
cool, man. I like what you're doing. I was just going to ask y'all, I heard you talking earlier about aliens being different sizes, and it gave me a spectacular idea. I thought that it might be possible with all the technology that maybe they could dominate the world of the micro, and maybe they're affecting the world in ways that we couldn't even detect.
Well, indeed, they... You know, if they're as advanced as it seems that they are, one of the questions that we would have to ask is, why the heck are they even allowing us to see them at all? Why would they need us to see them? They might have the ability to be absolutely invisible. They might have the ability to, just bypass us altogether. Are they interested in humanity? My personal opinion is that the human race is a very, very interesting show going on in this part of the galaxy right now, because we're right on the cusp of being able to leap right into their world. We are one generation away from hyper-intelligent computing technology, genetic engineering. So we're about ready to reinvent ourselves as a species, let alone as a civilization. And this is why I think that we're seeing these other beings now, because I think they're interested in us in particular right now. They may have been here all along. We've just never been able to really interact and see them in much. Now we can. Now we're about to wake up, and we're, as a species, as a civilization. And I think anyone who's got any ability to observe us is probably doing that right now.
The late Zechariah Sitchin, what do you think of his theory?
Well, what he argues is that humanity has been manipulated, genetically manipulated, and kind of created by extraterrestrials who essentially use us as property. I don't think it's an impossible theory.
No.
I'm aware of a lot of critiques of Sitchin's work, of the specifics of his scholarship, that do make me wonder exactly how exact and how accurate this was. But I'm not willing to throw out what he says. There are a lot of people who really delved into this deeper than I have.
Thank you so much, Richard Dolan. Great couple hours as we talked about an FBI UFO document. Up next, Life on Anubis, Machines and Man.